You're listening to Flashpoints on KPFA. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're now joined by Vincent Bugliosi. He's written a very interesting book that started out as a Nation magazine article and then was expanded into the book, The Betrayal of America, How the Supreme Court Undermined the Constitution and Chose Our President. Welcome to Flashpoints, Mr. Bugliosi.
I'm happy to be on the show, Dennis. Thank you for inviting me.
Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about your own background, because you ain't no, shall we say, born-again liberal. Talk a little bit about what work you've been doing before you wrote this book.
Well, I was a prosecutor in the DA's office down in L.A. for several years, and then I've been in private practice, and I've gotten into writing, and mostly I write about true crime, and my big book, of course, was Helter Skelter, based on my prosecution of Charles Manson. And then other books I've written, And the Sea Will Tell, that was a murder case I tried up in San Francisco, actually, and Outrage, The Five Reasons Why O.J. Simpson Got Away with Murder. Those books got up to number one on the New York Times bestseller list, so I've been writing quite a bit in recent years and also lecturing. But I view myself as a moderate. I'm not predictable. Let me say off the top, Dennis, that if the United States Supreme Court had done for Al Gore what it did for George Bush, I can give you a 100% guarantee I would have been writing the same identical book. On December the 12th, in my very firm opinion, Dennis, five Supreme Court justices, five out of the nine, committed one of the very biggest crimes, most serious crimes in American history when they stopped the recount in Florida, took the election away from the American people and handed it to George Bush. And in a fair and just world, I believe that they belong behind prison bars as much as any American white-collar criminal who ever lived. Yet, despite their monumental crime, as I'm talking to you at this precise moment, they've completely gotten away with it. They're still seated on the highest court in the land, obviously. They're still treated with the utmost respect by the established institutions of America, including, Dennis, the mainstream media, who don't even want to talk about what the court did anymore. Their position is the election is over with, and we've moved on to covering other matters. Now, this is the same group of people, Dennis, and I'll get into the evidence showing the court's crime in a moment, but this is the same group of people that pursued President Clinton not just day after day, not just week after week, not just month after month, but year after year for lying about a private consensual sexual affair. And yet here we're talking about what I believe to be the theft of the presidency, and they're saying the election is over with, we're covering other matters. That would be like the Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg saying, you know, the war is over with, let's get on with our lives. Now, obviously, the election being over with is not a defense to what these five justices did. And with respect to what they did, I will stake my prosecutorial reputation on the fact that within the pages of my book, The Betrayal of America, I prove beyond all reasonable doubt that these five justices deliberately set out to hand the election to George Bush. The evidence against them is absolutely overwhelming. Like typical criminals, Dennis, they left their incriminating fingerprints everywhere. Now, getting into the evidence that I set forth in The Betrayal of America, which incidentally is up to number five this week on the New York Times trade paperback bestseller list, how do you defend these five justices, Dennis, when they themselves, in so many words, in effect, confessed to the crime? How did they confess? Give me 30 seconds. I'll try to summarize it, how they, by necessary implication, confessed to this crime. They confessed when they said that their ruling that different standards to count votes in Florida violated the Equal Protection Clause only applied, they said, to Bush v. Gore, not to other cases. But, Dennis, if their ruling set forth a valid legal principle, why, and it was good enough for Bush v. Gore, why wasn't it good enough for other cases? Constitutional scholars will tell you that this is the first time in the 210-year history of the court that the court limited its ruling to the case before it, saying that it did not constitute legal precedent for other cases. In this fact alone, and I offer much, much more evidence in The Betrayal of America, but this fact alone and all by itself shows that these five justices were up to no good, that they themselves knew that their ruling was bogus and fraudulent and only a means to hand the election to George Bush. Because if their ruling, Dennis, was based on the law, there's no reason under the moon why they would have said it did not apply to other cases. I just want to read to you, for your non-lawyers out there, most of your audience would be non-lawyers, an opinion from Justice Scalia in 1996, United States versus Virginia, 518 U.S. 515. Quote, the Supreme Court of the United States does not sit to announce unique dispositions. Its principal function is to establish precedent, that is to set forth principles of law that every court in America must follow, unquote. But not in Bush v. Gore, the only exception in the 210-year history of the court. And the reason they did that, Dennis, is because they knew if they applied their ruling around the country, it would literally invalidate elections throughout the 50 states because there are different standards to count votes throughout the country. And they were only concerned about one election, not the elections around the country, the one that determined who was going to sit in the Oval Office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. But 3 days earlier, the recount started in Florida, December the 9th, 8 o'clock. This was a recount that the Florida Supreme Court ordered under Section 102.168 of the Florida Election Code of about 60,000 undervotes. The undervotes are the votes that, for whatever reason, are not picked up by the Votomatic machine, and you have to visually inspect them to see if there's a clear indication of the voter's intent. At 8 o'clock in the morning, Saturday, December 9th, Bush's lead had shrunk over Gore to 154 votes. At 2 in the afternoon, Scalia steps in, Justice Antonin Scalia, with an emergency order supported by the other four justices. I refer to them as the Felonious Five. And this is what he said, Dennis, and I'm not making this up because you can't make up stuff like this. It's too far out. He said that we're going to stop this recount because if it continues, it could, quote, threaten irreparable harm to George Bush, unquote. So even though the election had not yet been decided, the incredible Scalia, and there's no other adjective I can use to describe this fellow, was presupposing that Bush had won the election, indeed had a right to win it, and any recount that showed that Gore had won would threaten irreparable harm to George Bush. Now, I would ask you to hypothesize a reversal of roles. Let's assume that Gore was ahead December the 9th, 8 o'clock, by 154 votes. Would Scalia have done the same thing for Gore as he did for Bush? Who is Scalia? Well, he's not a typical Republican or a typical conservative. What he is, he's a right-wing ideologue. He's the darling of the judicial right. To him, I imagine someone like Gore is anathema, an execration. It is absolutely inconceivable that Scalia would have stepped in and said, we've got to stop the recount because if it continues, it could, quote, threaten irreparable harm to Al Gore, unquote. That would not have happened. And anyone who will tell me with a straight look, and anyone who can tell me with a straight look on their face that it would have happened, I will personally nominate that person for an Academy Award. Now, what does it mean when we say that it's obvious Scalia would not have done the same thing for Gore as he did for Bush? Well, what it means, obviously, is that he did not base his ruling on the law, because if he based his ruling on the law, it would apply equally to both parties. And many legal conservatives are embarrassed by what the court did here, and they've attacked the court. They don't go as far as I go, of course, because I'm talking about the fact that they're criminals and they deserve to be behind bars. But they've attacked the ruling, and I'll just give you one example. Terrence Sandilow is a former dean, University of Michigan Law School. He's a judicial conservative, opposed Roe v. Wade, supported the nomination to the court of right-wing icon Robert Bork. And he said that Scalia's order was, quote, incomprehensible. It was an unmistakably partisan decision that had no foundation in law, unquote. There's no doubt in my mind that these five set out to commit a judicial coup d'etat. They deliberately committed the unpardonable sin of being surrogates for the Republican Party, as opposed to being impartial arbiters of the law. And the stark reality is that this is a institution that Americans look up to the most. We revere the Supreme Court. We trust them the most to protect our freedoms and our principles, and yet they committed, in my opinion, one of the biggest, most serious crimes in American history.
We're speaking with Vincent Bugliosi. He's got a brand new book, The Betrayal of America. It started as an article in The Nation magazine, got the most response of any article that ever appeared in that magazine's over 100-year history. And the book is about how the Supreme Court undermined the Constitution and chose the president. Now, you've been talking about a Supreme Court. You allude that they are in the firm grasp of the extreme right wing. Make the case that they are. Tell us something about who these people are and what about their backgrounds would lead you to say that.
I would say that three of them are really right wing ideologues. The two to the furthest to the right would be Scalia and Thomas, who doesn't even try to create the impression that he's thinking. He's just a professional minor bird for Scalia. Rehnquist, the Chief Justice, also is extremely conservative. The two that aren't quite as conservative are Sandra Day O'Connor and Justice Anthony Kennedy. But everyone knows that these five are conservative, and everyone knows, obviously, that they wanted Bush to win. There's no question about that. But that doesn't mean that they did what I said they did. What shows that they did what I said they did is the evidence, not the motive. And if all I had was motive here, I never would have written The Betrayal of America. The night of the election, Dennis, November the 7th, Sandra Day O'Connor was at a cocktail party in Washington, D.C. with her lawyer husband, John. Dan Rather gets on the air at 8 o'clock, and he announces that it looks like Florida is going for Al Gore, whereupon O'Connor blurts out, "That's just terrible." She was angry. She was upset. Her husband, I guess somewhat embarrassed, had to explain to the guests why his wife was so upset, that they had planned to retire to Arizona. Now they were going to have to wait for 4 years because he said his wife did not want a Democrat to support appoint her successor. The Wall Street Journal found three witnesses who confirmed that story. Newsweek found two. Both the Wall Street Journal and Newsweek went to Sandra Day O'Connor, asked her for a comment. She declined comment. Scalia's wife works for the Heritage Foundation, a very conservative think tank that assisted Governor Bush in his transition to power. Scalia, everyone knows, it's not a secret at all, that he wants to become the Chief Justice, and obviously he could never become the Chief Justice if a Democrat got in, but more specifically, he had two sons that at the time of the election were working for law firms that were heavily involved in the Bush campaign. And I want to read to you an applicable statute here, if I can find it. It's Title 28, United States Code, Section 455, which provides that any justice, judge, or magistrate of the United States shall, it's mandatory, disqualify himself in any proceeding in which his impartiality might reasonably be questioned. We're talking about a conflict of interest or even the appearance of a conflict of interest. He shall also disqualify himself in the following circumstances. He or his spouse or a person within the third degree of relationship to either of them is known by the judge to have an interest that could be substantially affected by the outcome of the proceeding. If there were an impeachment against these justices, this would be one of the articles of impeachment. Realistically, Congress is not going to impeach these five justices. They do not have the spine to do that. But any movement towards impeachment, Dennis, and any consideration at all given by Congress to the impeachment movement, I think would have enormous sociological significance.
Let me just jump in here and have you say a little bit more about Rehnquist. I mean, I do think it's significant, his early history in Phoenix in terms of intimidating people of color, because in this case, in this context, it was the people of color that voted overwhelmingly in Florida for Al Gore and became disenfranchised.
Yeah, I talk about what he did in Phoenix in the book, and I bring out something even more important than that, I think, just to show that these people, just because they're wearing robes, does not mean that they're incapable of criminality. I have about 5-6 pages in which I put together a very, very strong case against Rehnquist that in 1986 he committed the worst type of perjury, because there's different degrees of perjury, the worst type of perjury in 1986 at his confirmation hearings to become Chief Justice. He was a clerk for Justice Robert Jackson. I think it was 1954 or 53. In any event, Brown v. Board of Education was coming up, and the question is, should Brown v. Board of Education reverse Plessy versus Ferguson? That's the 1898 case that's held separate but equals. And he wrote a memorandum. He was working for Robert Jackson, saying that I recommend that Plessy versus Ferguson be affirmed. At his confirmation hearings, unbelievably, he said that when he used the word I, he was not referring to himself, he was referring to Justice Jackson. He knew, of course, that if he affirmed a racist ruling by the court, Plessy versus Ferguson, he never would have become Chief Justice. And I just give this example of Rehnquist committing perjury in 1986 to show that these are a typical human beings subject to all the frailties of human beings. Let me talk just a little further about the Equal Protection Clause. Now, we know that the court did not believe in it themselves, because if they did, they would not have said it did not apply to other cases. But since they based their ruling on the Equal Protection Clause, let's examine it a little more closely. What evidence, Dennis, could there possibly be, empirical, anecdotal, or otherwise, that different standards to count votes in the various Florida counties would hurt George Bush more than Al Gore? How could there possibly be any evidence to support that proposition? I mean, you'd have to have someone saying, you know, I just have a gut feeling that somehow it's going to hurt Bush more than Gore. The Bush legal team, in oral argument and legal briefs, never even made that allegation. That allegation was never made. And if the court wasn't concerned about Bush, but the voters themselves, as they so fervently claimed to be, then under what conceivable theory would they, in effect, tell these voters, we're so concerned that some of you undervoters may lose your vote because of the different standards to count votes in Florida, that we're going to solve the problem by making sure that none of you undervoters have your votes counted. They threw out all 60,000 undervotes. So, in effect, 60,000 Floridians never had their vote counted. In effect, again, the court told 60,000 American citizens, we're going to protect your right to vote by not counting any of your votes. That just shows that the equal protection argument was nothing but a legal gimmick to hand the election to George Bush, and that an election for an American president can be stolen by the highest court in the land, Dennis, under the deliberate pretext of an inapplicable constitutional provision, has got to be one of the most frightening and dangerous events ever to happen in this country. And if any of your listeners are not frightened by this, I would say to them, you should be. You certainly should be.
We're speaking with Vincent Bugliosi. His book is The Betrayal of America, and it's about, he says, how the Supreme Court undermined the Constitution and chose President. Mr. Bugliosi will be speaking Thursday night in the Bay Area. We'll give you more information about that after this interview. Finally, sir, what does this say for future elections?
These justices had no respect, no regard for 50 million Americans whose votes for Vice President Gore they knew they were erasing as if never cast. No concern at all about a betrayal of trust, and that's why I call the book The Betrayal of America. A betrayal of trust, Dennis, that may be unparalleled in the recorded annals of American history, but I have to repeat that as I'm talking to you at this moment, they have completely gotten away with it, and one reason is the media. You know, the election's over, what they're saying. They're also saying silly things like, well, Bush won anyway under the newspaper recount. Well, number one, the most recent recount by the USA Today and Miami Herald, May 11th, said that using two standards to count votes, Bush wins. Using two other standards, Gore wins. The consortium of the LA Times, Chicago Tribune, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, they haven't come out with their findings yet, but let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that Bush wins the recount. Totally, completely, utterly irrelevant. When you commit a crime, the bell is rung, Dennis, the moment you engage in your conduct, nothing that happens thereafter can unring that bell, and therefore is completely irrelevant. So to judge these justices by the final result, whatever they turn out to be, rather than by their intentions at the time they engage in their conduct, would be like exonerating someone who shoots to kill if the bullet happens to miss the victim. It's all nonsense. It's all silliness. We have to examine what this court did. And if they did what I say they did, then the punishment that I'm recommending is not that severe at all. There have been people, Dennis, who have been executed in this country for doing things infinitely less serious than stealing a presidential election. We're talking about altering the course of American history for good or for bad. And when you alter American history, you alter world history. So nothing could be more serious than what these five justices did. And I'm just trying to get that message out in The Betrayal of America.
We're going to have to leave it right there. You're going to be in the Bay Area on Thursday. We're going to have some more information about that. The name of your book is The Betrayal of America, How the Supreme Court Undermined the Constitution and Chose the President, or Our President. Thank you very much for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you so much, Dennis, for having me on the show.
And Vincent Bugliosi will be appearing tomorrow night, August 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Grand Lake Theater. That's at 3200 Grand Lake Avenue in Oakland. Tickets are $15. Also appearing will be Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange and Reva Entine of the National Lawyers Guild. And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs from 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. Flashpoints is produced by Dennis Bernstein with associate producers Noelle Hanrahan and Young Su. Our technical director is Mary Bishop. If you have questions or comments, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 604. For a taped copy of this broadcast, call 848-6767, extension 625. An archive of our recent shows can be heard on the web at www.flashpoints.net. Many thanks to John Lionheart, our web maestro, and thank you for listening.